You can open your Bibles to Mark 15. You know, since they moved Easter, it's working out like we're actually going to get to chapter 16 on Easter Sunday. How about that? That doesn't happen very often. When we started this book a year and a half ago, and it was not planned, at least not by me, that we reached the Easter story on Easter Sunday a year and a half after we started. So I look forward to what the Lord has for us there. When you hear the word king, what comes to mind? A crown, a robe, a scepter, maybe a sword, you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and Excalibur, that big sword in the stone, you know, just like in the Disney cartoon. Remember when my mom took me to see that cartoon? I loved it. I just loved it. Came home, Archimedes, remember him, the owl? Highly recommend it. Not exactly, you know, stunning cinema, but it's a good story. Anyway, what do you think of when you hear the word king? Do you think of an oppressive tyrant abusing their authority for personal gain and advantage? Or do you think of a benevolent dictator whose primary aim is to bring peace and prosperity to his people? Now, to say that Jesus is king is a simple statement of fact. We just sang that. You are my king. But when you call him king, what kind of king do you have in mind? See, when the chief priests and elders and scribes called him king, they had one thing in mind. When the Roman governor called him king, he had another thing in mind altogether. Now, it is absolutely true that Jesus is, in fact, king. But where is his kingdom? What's the nature of that kingdom? And what kind of king is he? Who is he king over? And probably the most important question, is he your king? In these first few verses of Mark 15, we're going to see what kind of king Jesus is. And it's my hope, and it's been my prayer all week, that by the time we're through here, you will make him your king personally. Let's start reading in verse 1 of Mark chapter 15. It says, immediately, that's Mark's favorite word, in the morning, this is the morning after that first trial that happened in the middle of the night. Remember, Jesus spent the night praying while his followers spent the night sleeping in the Garden of Gethsemane. And just, you know, in the wee hours of the morning, Judas had come with that mob with swords and clubs, and they grabbed Jesus and they hauled him off to the high priest's house where all the elders and chief priests and scribes were gathered in an illegal kangaroo court. It was illegal for them to meet at night. To make it a legal deal, they had to meet, you know, in the light of day, in public, in the open. But since this whole thing was kind of on the sneak and on the sly, and it wasn't altogether according to the rules, they had met in the middle of the night. Now, it says, in the morning, sunup, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, the Sanhedrin, the ruling council of 70, and they bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate. And then Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? He answered and said to him, it is as you say. Literally, you've said it. And the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. Then Pilate asked him again, saying, do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you? But Jesus still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. Now, the feast At the feast, he, that's Pilate, was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow rebels. They'd committed murder in the rebellion. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he'd always done for them. But Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them. Pilate answered and said to them again, "What then do you want me to do with him whom you call the king of the Jews?" So they cried out again, "Crucify him." Then Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he'd scourged him to be crucified. What kind of king is Jesus? First thing we see here is that he is not a political king. In the morning, they held a consultation. See, they had to make their conviction legal in the light of day. They'd already decided what to do before they ever found him, before they arrested him. They'd already decided he was guilty and deserving of death. But in order to make this whole thing legal, they had to do it in the daylight. So this is now the second trial, or I guess you could call it a trial. That's, you know, it's a phase two of what they began in the secret, in the dark. Now we know from history that Jesus was crucified around 9 in the morning. So this had to be just after sunup, because he's got to go to Pilate, and he's going to go to one of the Herods, and then back to Pilate, and so forth and so on. So here we are just after sunup. You know, as I said, he had prayed all night, and they had arrested him still when it was still dark out. Remember that on the Jewish calendar, on the Hebrew calendar, a day goes from sundown to sundown. Not midnight to midnight, the way we think of it. So it would have been a Wednesday night after dark when they shared that Passover meal. Judas left during that meal to betray Jesus. They finished the meal. They walked out of Jerusalem across the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives, specifically the Garden of Gethsemane, that garden with an olive press where Jesus went off by himself to pray, and he told the disciples to watch and pray, but they didn't. They fell asleep, not once, not twice. You know, the third time's the charm. Finally, he said, "That's enough. Here they come," and there they were. And Judas came up and kissed him on the cheek again and again and again to identify him as the one in question. And the guards said, you know, or Jesus asked the guards, "Who are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus." And he said, "Well, that's me. Let these other guys go." And they did, and they arrested him. Still dark, still that same evening. Remember, the day began at sundown. So we have dinner, we have the Garden of Gethsemane, we have the arrest in the middle of the night, wee hours of the morning, who knows, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. And then that phony trial, and then now that it's sunup, they make this trial public, and of course they just kind of ratify what they've already decided. This guy has to die. Problem is, the Jews didn't have the authority to execute anyone. That authority had long since been stripped from them. Only Rome, only the governor, Pilate, had the authority to sentence someone to death. And of course, the Jews knew that. And so that's why it says at the end of verse 1, they bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Pontius Pilate, Procurator of Judea. Governor would be another way to say it. Some refer to him as the prefect or prefectus, a Roman term, a Latin term. But governor is good enough for me. As governor over the territory of Judea, Pilate was answerable directly to Caesar. So it was a lot of responsibility, sent there by Caesar, assigned to Judea by Caesar to be the overseeing Roman authority over what was, at least from Rome's perspective, Roman territory, Judea. The Jews saw things a little differently, but that was Rome's perspective. Interesting about Pilate, For hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of years, Pilate was thought to be a mythical figure. There didn't seem to be any evidence that he ever actually existed. And the skeptics, critics of the Bible, would point to that fact and say, there's no such guy, there's no such record of any Pontius Pilate ever existing, let alone being governor of Judea. That is, until 1961, when they were excavating at Caesarea by the sea, and they uncovered a stone tablet, which is on display to this very day at Caesarea, that announces or names the procurator, Pontius Pilate. So there we have the myth shot down and Bible history verified. Isn't it funny how the world, this is kind of beside the point, but the world wants to use science and archaeology and those discoveries to verify the Bible, when if they just had their head screwed on straight, they'd realize that the Bible actually verifies archaeology and science. But that's their approach. And so far, it's the Bible 100%. Archaeology, not so much. Now that it's light out, they can ratify this thing and they take Jesus to Pilate. You know, to be procurator of Judea was not a desirable gig. It was to be, if you're in the Navy, you know, and you'll hear the words Diego Garcia come to mind. And the Navy guys chuckle and nobody else gets it. That's a lot like Israel was to a Roman, you know, citizen, a desert land far away in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of weird religious people with these weird religious traditions that you don't recognize or respect or honor in any way. You know, the whole idea was just repulsive to a cultured Roman, especially a governor, you know, a government official. Not only that, but in Judea, the people resisted Roman laws and Roman ways at every turn, every opportunity they got. The people he was supposed to govern were anything but cooperative with his governing. Now, Pontius Pilate, as Rome in general, had a tendency to rule with an iron fist. It was very much my way or the highway, and the highway usually meant that you ended up, you know, in a box underground. And that was his leadership style, I guess, if you want to call it that. He was entirely insensitive to Jewish laws and Jewish tradition. Just one little illustration of that. When Pilate was first sent to Judea, his boat would have landed up north around Caesarea where the governor's palace was. And after a short season of settling in, he decided to visit Jerusalem, which was the, you know, well, although Caesarea was the political capital, Jerusalem, of course, was and remains the Jewish, the religious capital. And part of their, company that marched down to Jerusalem, they had these standards with flags on them, with emblems that would identify which battalion or, you know, which part of the army you were with, a lot like this flagpole here. And on the top of these standards, where this, we have this eagle, there was a little bust, a little figurine of Caesar. Well, when they marched into Jerusalem with those, and they marched through the gates up into the temple area to that area where the Praetorian Guard was headquartered, which was right off one corner of the Temple Mount, the Jews just about went crazy because those little figurines on the top of the standards were considered carved or graven images. It was a direct violation of the second commandment. Thou shalt not make any image of God or a graven or carved image. And so they just wouldn't have it. And then Pilate, with his sort of puffed up Roman, you know, my way or the highway authority, just said, he just ignored their complaints, really, or tried to, until it became such a mess that he packed up his whole gang and they went back to Caesarea. But the Jewish leaders followed him because they weren't ready to let it go. This was a complete affront to everything that they held holy and dear, and they weren't going to let it go. And they followed Pilate back to Caesarea, and there they are gathered in the courtyard of the palace. And Pilate finally gets to the point where he says, in effect, you've either got to let this go or, you know, guards off with their heads. And I think it was 90, if I remember the number right, 60, 80, 100, somewhere in there, but approximately 90 Jewish leaders kind of bent over, pulled their collar back and their hair and said, right about here ought to do it. And Pilate realized that if word got back to Caesar that his way of governing these people was to cut off the heads of the leaders at, you know, in the first few days or weeks of his governorship, that wasn't going to fly well. So he backed off and he promised never to do that again. Another reason the Jews weren't fond of Pilate is because Pilate had this vision. He wanted to do something big that would get back to Caesar and kind of, you know, give him some merit with the emperor. And so Pilate proposed that they build an aqueduct to carry water from Mount Hermon down to Caesarea. It's like 50, 60 miles, maybe a little further. As a matter of fact, you can see the remains of the aqueduct today. You can Google it, you know, Google Caesarea and see pictures of it still standing there. This pitched stone trough that carried water 60, 70 miles all the way down from Mount Hermon. The problem was that Pilate didn't have enough money to build this thing. But he had an idea. He disguised his guards as citizens, as regular, you know, Judean folks, and they went to the Temple Mount, the temple area, and they infiltrated the crowd until finally there were many, many of these guards in disguise. And then the signal was given and they pulled back their hoods and they pulled out their swords and they chased everybody out and they went into the Jewish treasury and stole enough money to build this aqueduct. So to put it mildly, he was no friend of the Jews and they were no friend of his. In verse 2, Pilate asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Because that was the charge against him. They brought him and said, "This man says he's the king of the Jews." And so he asked, "Is that right?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "You have said it." That would be a transliteration. "It is as you say. Are you the king?" "You said it, not me," kind of the idea. "You have said it." Now, when Pilate asked that question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" he was thinking, "Are you the political king of the Jews? You know, do you have a plan to govern these people? Do you propose to tax them? Do you propose to provide all the, you know, civil or civic responsibilities of government, such as building and maintaining roads?" That's what Pilate had in mind. You know, the Romans were incredible road builders. Wherever they went, they built the best roads. They widened and flattened and straightened and, you know, made travel easier than it had ever been in whatever part of the world that Rome was in charge of. And so Pilate was thinking, "Are you that kind of a king? Are you that political kind of a king?" And he was thinking, "Are you a military king? You know, do you intend to assemble an army? Do you intend to defend these people, protect these people? Do you intend to conquer the enemies, the surrounding people?" See, at that time, the world enjoyed what was called the Pax Romana, which means the Roman peace. The Roman military, by sheer virtue of their might and numbers, had established peace in a large part of the world, the Roman world, the part of the world that Rome governed or had conquered. And there just wasn't much trouble. You know, they had built those roads and they had patrolled those roads, and so the bandits and the pirates had kind of been put out of business. Travel was safe, travel was easy because of this military might. And so Pilate's asking, "Are you that kind of a king? Are you a political king? Are you a military king?" What he wasn't thinking was, "Are you a spiritual king?" Would never have occurred to Pilate to even think in those terms. Pilate had no interest in the Jewish religious law or punishing those who violated it. But when these Jewish leaders brought Jesus to Pilate and said, "This guy says he's the king of the Jews," Pilate thought, "Political king, military king. If word gets back to Caesar that there's someone proclaiming themselves king other than Caesar, then it'll be off with my head. And so even though he knew Jesus wasn't guilty of sedition, even though that was the charge, proclaiming himself king, Pilate had no choice, really, but to do something about it. I mean, they'd already sent him to Judea. You know, how much worse could it get? I guess death would be the next thing. Jesus is not a political king. Number two, what he is he's a spiritual king. Verse 3. They accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, Do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you. But Jesus still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. Jesus offered no defense, you know. Pilate said, Do you hear all the things that they're accusing you of? Don't you have something to say? Don't you want to explain? Pilate's looking for a way to let Jesus off the hook. But Jesus isn't cooperating with Pilate's idea. He's silent. But the fact is, his silence testified to the kind of king that he was. Now, the Jews should have recognized this, at the very least. If you look in Isaiah 53, a decidedly messianic passage, the suffering servant passage. While you're finding Isaiah 53, kind of a little aside, I'm told, and I can't say this for certain, but I'm told that as the rabbis teach through the Old Testament scriptures, that they skip chapter 53 of Isaiah. And the reason they do that is because it is so clearly messianic and so clearly describes Jesus that they would just rather not have to deal with it. Isaiah 53, starting right in the first verse. Who's believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. You know, there's nothing about Jesus' appearance that would draw people to him. He's despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So much for happy Jesus laughing his way through 3 years of ministry. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. You know, we thought that he really had it rough. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, and here it is, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, you know, the Passover lamb to be precise, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. The Jews accused him. Jesus remained silent. And Pilate marveled. Because none of this made sense to him. It didn't make sense because Jesus wasn't a political king. Although, one day he will be. There will be that time at the end of what's called the tribulation, that 7-year period that immediately follows or shortly follows the rapture. Satan will be bound, and Jesus will return to earth with his people, the church, and set up a literal, physical government. He will sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And it says in Revelation 20 that his people, that's us, will rule with him. Can you imagine such a thing? Remember the parable of the talents, you know, he who is faithful with much, much is given, but he who is faithful with a little. So would you rather be in charge of Tootle or New York City? You know, if you're faithful with much. Now, He wasn't a political king, but he will be. Now, I can't really stop the story there. I can't really stop the end times explanation there. We kind of have to finish that out. After that thousand-year reign, the millennium, that's what a thousand means. After the millennium, Satan will be released, and the stage will be set for a great military battle, if I can borrow Saddam Hussein's, the mother of all battles. His mother of all battles kind of fizzled, but this one won't. And just as the bombs and the bullets are about to fly, the Lord will intervene. God will say, hold it, that's it, time's up, it's over. And he will destroy the earth by fire, create a new earth, new heaven and new earth, on which God's people will spend eternity learning, exploring, and enjoying the universe that God has waiting for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose, all those who receive eternal life by grace through faith in Jesus. He will be a political king. At this point, he's not. Verse 6. Now the feast, at the feast, remember we're at the Passover time, Pilate was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas who was chained with his fellow rebels. They'd committed murder in the rebellion. And the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he'd always done for them. You know, they were demanding, come on, release a prisoner. You do it every year. We want to let somebody go. And they got to pick. It was kind of their, you know, a game, in a sense, for them to play every year to decide which prisoner would be set free. Every year, one criminal released for the feast. Now, Pilate's idea in doing this was to garner favor with the Jews. Remember how much they were opposed to him. That business with the standards coming into the holy city. That business with stealing the money from the treasury. And finally, this was one thing that Pilate could do to be kind of benevolent and generous to gain their favor, or at least offset a little bit some of the offenses that he did. Now, it tells us that there was a man named Barabbas, chained with his fellow rebels, and they'd committed murder in the rebellion. Barabbas is a significant name. The first part, you have to break it in two. Bar-abbas. The first part, bar, means son of. Remember when at Peter's great confession of Jesus, Jesus said, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of Jonah or son of John. That bar prefix always means son of. It's like a bar mitzvah. It has to do with boys with a girl. It's a bat mitzvah. Bar, son of, and Abba, we learned a couple weeks ago, means it's that intimate term for daddy or papa. So son of papa, son of the father. Barabbas literally means son of the father. It tells us he was a rebel. He was guilty of murder. And he was, by all accounts, deserving of a death sentence. Now compare Barabbas, son of the father, with Jesus, the son of the Father. Jesus is not a rebel, not guilty of a single sin, and definitely not deserving of death. Now, the historians will say that Barabbas, the Bible doesn't say this, but the historians say that Barabbas' first name was Jesus, Yeshua, a very common name. So we have Jesus Barabbas, the son of the Father, and Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of the Father. This is the clearest possible living illustration of Jesus' ministry that there could ever be. Look at it. The innocent one condemned to death while the guilty receives a pardon. The rebellious one being released from the consequences of their rebellion. And the multitude given the option. That's what verses 8 through 11 are all about. The multitude, crying aloud, began to ask Pilate to do just as he'd always done for them. Pilate answered, saying, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? You know, he thought this is a great opportunity to kind of get rid of this deal. They've come and accused him, but hey, I get to grant a pardon to somebody. So, hey, how about Jesus? How about this so-called king of the Jews? tells us he knew, verse 10, that the chief priests had handed him over because of their envy. He wasn't guilty of anything, and Pilate recognized that. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that they should rather release Barabbas to them. The multitude, given the choice, who to release, Barabbas or Jesus? See, as a multitude, we can't change what kind of king Jesus is. But we can determine whose king Jesus is. That's because more than anything, Jesus is a personal king. He's not a political king. He's a spiritual, or you might even say it better, he's a scriptural king, a theological king. But mostly he's a personal king. In verse 12, Pilate answered and said to the crowd, "What then do you want me to do with him whom you call the King of the Jews?" You know, he wasn't going to call him. He'd already called him King of the Jews once. I think he kind of caught himself. I can't say that. But that one that you call the King of the Jews, you know, political correctness and trying to, you know, do what politicians do by juggling words to say what they want to say without meaning what they don't want them to mean. This may be the most important question ever. In fact, I think let's just say that it is. What do you want me to do with him whom you call the King of the Jews? See, what will you do with Jesus? It's the most important question you'll ever face. What will you personally do with Jesus? You and I are all Barabbas. We're sons and daughters of the Father. Little s, little d. We've rebelled. We're guilty. We're deserving of the death sentence. But Jesus died in our place for our sake because of our sin. That's the kind of king he is. A king who doesn't seek his own pleasure or advantage, but a king who surrenders everything up to and including his own life for the sake, for the benefit of the subjects of his kingdom. Deciding who Jesus is and what to do with him is the pivot point between eternity with God and eternity apart from God. It is the fork in the road that determines whether we'll spend eternity with God or apart from God. And it's a decision that everybody faces, and there are only two choices. He's either your king or he's not. See, Jesus is who he is, and that doesn't change. That has never and will never change. It's kind of like gravity. You know, gravity is real whether you believe in it or not, whether you're aware of it or not. Now, when you become aware of it and begin to believe in it, then you conduct yourself in a way that, you know, is better than not knowing about gravity. You are more careful about where you jump and how you don't fall, because you understand that what goes up must come down. That's just a reality that can't change. Now, you could choose to ignore gravity, but as I said, it doesn't change the fact that gravity's real. Now the question is, just like gravity, will the effect that Jesus has work for you or against you? Because there are no other options. Will he be your king personally, or will he be your judge eternally? That's the choice that's set before each of us. Verse 13, it says, they cried out again, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, let the guilty go free, and he delivered Jesus, the only innocent man, after he had scourged him, to be crucified. This ought to make an impact. The King of Glory, the Creator and sustainer of existence, the cosmic glue that prevents the atoms from flying apart, scourged and crucified for our sin. Scourging involved an instrument called a flagellum, sometimes called a cat of nine tails. Would be a stick, foot and a half, maybe 2 feet long. On the end of that stick would be several leather straps, again, foot and a half to 2 feet long. On the end of each little leather strap would be tied a rock or a piece of metal or a piece of broken glass, intentionally sharp. And as you use that thing like a whip, just like a bullwhip, you know how a bullwhip cracks because the tip, even though you're swinging this way, the tip of the thing is going so fast it actually breaks the sound barrier. That's what that is, a little sonic burst. And they bring that thing down, and the stones and the rocks and the glass are designed to cut into the flesh and then rip it off, virtually peeling the skin off the individual, as well as the muscle and all the other tissue that's anywhere near the surface. And they would beat you and beat you, and when your back was bloody and hamburger, they would roll you over and beat you from the front. And if the guy had bad aim, he might miss your chest and hit your face. It was just a gruesome, awful thing. Normally the sentence would be 40 lashes. Can you imagine? 40 lashes with this thing. 40 was the number of judgment. 39 was the number of mercy. So if they wanted to be, one less than judgment is mercy. So if they wanted to be merciful, they would give you 39 of those. Now, I've seen The Passion of the Christ. By the way, we're going to show that film here the Wednesday before Easter, but that's, I should have said that earlier. I saw that film, and really, I think they kind of watered it down. As gruesome as it is, they warned you, oh, it's so violent, it's so awful. And then I finally went and saw it, and I went, well, they really took it easy compared to what happened, the way the Bible describes it. By the time they were done with him, you couldn't even recognize him as a human being. Mercy, 39. Most people just died. They either bled to death or lost so much blood they went into shock and eventually their heart would stop. Jesus survived. Although he was so wounded that he was unable to carry his own cross piece up to the top of Golgotha. We'll talk more about that later. Sentences him to this scourging. And then they led him to be crucified. They led him to be tied and nailed through the wrists, through the feet. Some say it was to a tree with a cross piece. Some say it was one of those traditional, like a 4x4 or a 6x6 kind of lumberyard looking thing. Whatever it was rough hewn. Tied, nailed, left to suffocate under the weight of his own body. The way that works is, and I actually saw a guy on TV let himself, they passed on the nail part, but they tied him to a thing and, and took away the deal he was standing on, and he lasted about 6 seconds. Get me off of here. And this is a healthy guy. He hasn't been beaten to near death. And as you hang there, the weight of your own body sags down, your shoulders pop out of joint. So you're hanging even further. And the way the mechanics of that works on your diaphragm is that you basically have inhaled as much air as you can possibly hold. And then you have to push up on those feet with the nails in them to blow out the air. And then as you relax, it's drawn back in like a bellows. And then ultimately you suffocate under the weight of your own body. Turn to Psalm 22. Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22 are those decidedly messianic passages that deal specifically with the crucifixion. Psalm 22, and we'll start in verse 11. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there's none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me, bull being a symbol of strength, strong men. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me, no doubt thinking of those Roman soldiers. They gape at me with their mouths like a raging and roaring lion, you know, laughing, ridiculing, mocking. I'm poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint, speaking of those shoulders pulled out of their sockets. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clings to my jaws. You know, he said on the cross, I'm thirsty, and they took a sponge and a stick and put it in vinegar and lifted it up to him, but he refused to take it. You've brought me to the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. You know, his bones weren't broken. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and my clothing, for my clothing, they cast lots, which we see back in Mark 15, if you look up to verse 24. When they crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. What we have here in Psalm 22 is a point-by-point description of crucifixion. But here's the thing. When David wrote this psalm, crucifixion hadn't been invented yet. It was hundreds of years away. What did David see in his mind's eye as he wrote this description? Did he realize what he was writing? My feeling is he probably didn't. But as the word says, carried along by the Spirit, he wrote under the inspiration of the Spirit and described this thing exactly like it was going to happen. The King of Glory, crucified or scourged and crucified. Now, see, here's the thing. They thought, the Romans thought, the Jews thought, that by killing Jesus, they wouldn't have to deal with reality. You know, we can just make him go away, you know, out of sight, out of mind, then we won't have to confront our own failures, our own weakness, our own sin. We won't have to deal with the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, sin and righteousness, the evil in our own hearts. We won't have to deal with the reality that even at our best, we are selfish and sinful by nature. They thought if we can just get rid of him, we won't have to deal with that reality. And that's what people think today, because they just don't want to deal with him. Some people try to explain Jesus away. You had to have heard about this film, this James Cameron film, where apparently in Jerusalem they found the bones of Jesus, thereby proving that he didn't die, or that he died and stayed dead. And of course, what they don't tell you is that discovery is about 9 or 10 years old. And about 2 days after the discovery, the experts determined that this is not Jesus of the Bible. This is not, you know, Mary Magdalene. In fact, the little ossuary that they claim says Mary Magdalene actually has two names on it. Mary, and then after a while they put somebody else's bones in there too, you know, because property's, I don't know, expensive or something. Those boxes are not only that, but then you have to ask them, well, why was Jesus, I mean, Jesus was from Nazareth. If he was killed and if he didn't rise from the dead and he, you know, stayed dead, then why wasn't he buried in the family tomb in Nazareth where Joseph, you know, years before had died and was most likely, you know, most probably buried? And why would they get Joseph and dig him up and bring him to Jerusalem? And then the answer is, well, because Jesus was the leader of a big religion in Jerusalem after, you know. And so really, you know, there's not one shred of historical evidence, no mention of Jesus after the crucifixion. Of course, the Bible talks about the resurrection, but the historical record covers his life and his crucifixion, but there's not even a hint that he was around, you know, physically after that, except for these New Testament gospel accounts. Just a crazy, crazy idea. You can shoot so many holes in that balloon, you know. But people will try to explain away Jesus. People will try to redefine Jesus. Well, you know, okay, there was a real Jesus and he lived, but he wasn't the Son of God. He wasn't the Messiah, even though he clearly said he was. He called himself the Son of Man. He told the woman at Jacob's well in John 4, Messiah, You're looking at him. But they, you know, explain all that away, ignore all that, and they try to redefine him as just, well, he was a good teacher. You know that stuff in the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, murder in your heart, adultery in your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's all good stuff. And if we could just, boy, if we could just put that into practice, what a wonderful world it would be. But that's all he is just a good teacher. Well, I think it was C.S. Lewis that said he has not left that option open to us. And it's Josh McDowell who took that statement to the next level and put it this way. If Jesus said he was Messiah, and he clearly did, that really can't be argued. If he said he was Messiah and he knew that he wasn't, then he's the biggest liar of all time. If he said he was Messiah, if he really thought he was Messiah, but he wasn't, then he's a lunatic. He's the craziest man of all time. But if he said he was Messiah, if he thought he was Messiah, and he really was Messiah, that makes him Lord. And that makes dealing with him the most important, the only important issue in our lives. They try to explain him away. They try to redefine him. People try to ignore Jesus. Just pretend he doesn't exist. Just pretend this whole issue is not there. And, you know, kind of put, you know, hits the head in the sand ostrich approach. If I can't see it, I don't have to deal with it, you know. But none of that works. Because he is who he is. He is the king, and nothing can change that. Here's the only question. Is he your king? Is he your king personally? Does he sit on the throne of your life? I love that little diagram in the four spiritual laws. Little circle with all the little activities, little dots. And who sits on the throne? You know, my friend wrote a song called The Big Chair. I'm going to put God on the big chair of my life. I love that. Does he sit on the throne of your life? Does he direct your steps and guide your decisions? Do you serve him? See, if he's your king, then all of those will be true of you to some degree. You will serve him a little bit or a lot. He will direct your steps and guide your decisions a little bit or a lot. He will sit in the big chair on the throne of your life a little bit or a lot. But if none of those are true, you need to wonder, is he really my king? Have I made him my king? There is no better life than letting the king be your king.